Today's edition of the Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by us, Capital Daily. With a committed audience of over 41,000 people, get connected with some of the smartest, hippest people on the West Coast. For more details, visit capitaldaily.ca. Introducing the Capital Daily's Weekly Photo Challenge. Each week, our team will post a weekly photo theme in Monday's Capital Daily newsletter, as well as announcing it right here on the podcast, with winners receiving gift cards to local Victoria businesses around town. This week's theme is architecture. To find out how you can enter, check out Monday's Capital Daily newsletter. Hi, I'm Ben Waterworth, and welcome to the Capital Daily podcast for Friday, November 20th, 2020. Today on the podcast,
there really isn't a place that you can go to learn Coast Salish culture. You really have to immerse yourself in the culture to learn it.
We chat with local writer Meggie Champion about the importance of preserving the Hulkameenam language and why she was one of the early advocates for mask wearing in the early days of the pandemic. Meggie Champion is a Capital Daily contributor and probably one of the most interesting writers on Vancouver Island. She's been a National Post columnist, she founded a Coast Salish-based currency, and she studied the Hulkameenam language with the late Willie Seymour, who until his death in 2015 was one of only a few dozen fluent speakers of what was once the most widespread language on what is now Vancouver Island. And to chat more about this, as well as a variety of other interesting topics, it's a pleasure to welcome Meggie to the Capital Daily podcast with me right now. Meggie, thanks very much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me.
For a few months now, you've been doing a feature for us at the Capital Daily called Brush Up on Your Salish, where you feature different terms of the Hulkameenam language. Now, this is a language that was born and shaped by Vancouver Island, so the more you learn about it, the more you understand about this part of the world. For you, what's one of the terms that best highlights this? A Hulkameenam word that just doesn't have an adequate equivalent in English?
Snowyeth.
Snowyeth. Could you tell us a little bit more about that word?
Snowyeth is life's teachings. I think the actual translate, it doesn't really exactly translate into English, but it means things that you've learned from your teachers, from your elders, from your parents, from your family, all growing up. And it's like a set of principles or ideas for you know, better ways to live, rather than laws or regulations. So it's our equivalent of laws, really.
On a similar note, what can we learn about the land from learning about Hulkameenam names for geographic features? I mean, a lot of names we use for things around here don't really have a direct connection to the environment. Queen Victoria never came here and probably didn't even know we existed, and ditto with Wanda Fuca. So when we look at the traditional names for places, say, like Vancouver Island, do we learn something more illustrative of the place?
Well, we had place names for everything on Vancouver Island. We called Vancouver Island Teeskute, which means big island, because we did circumnavigate it, and we knew that it was an island. So the geography is an integral part of the language, and that's where our Indian names come from. Back east, they have different kinds of Indian names. Here in Coast Salish territory, an Indian name ties you to a place and to an ancestry, and they're inherited names.
In language isn't just words, of course, it's also the delivery of it. And one thing we've struggled with in putting together Brush Up Your Salish is that Hulkameenam is much more of a context-heavy language, much like, an Asian language. Korean famously has no word for no. They use a variety of more ambiguous terms based on the situation, such as it's not permitted. So when you're trying to convey the spirit of speaking Hulkameenam, what's something that English speakers have a lot of trouble getting their heads around?
Mostly it's that there's all sorts of sounds in Hulkameenam that we don't have in English. Depending on how you pronounce things, when you're pronouncing it, it can take on a different meaning or a different flavor. I don't know if that makes sense. I'm not fluent in the language by any stretch of the imagination. I'm more like a toddler in terms of my ability to speak it. I've got maybe 1,000 words so far, and I tried to learn a new word every single week. So I'm by no means an expert. I've got into learning the language because I wanted to learn my culture. And this is one thing that was available to me to learn my culture was the language.
If you wanted to get to that expert level, how long with a language like this would it take you to reach that level?
There are a few students who have become fluent in the last 10 years. There's a program at Simon Fraser University and at UVic that is teaching Halkominum, but it's a full-time program to take that. So, but we have managed to, like, we did all sorts of recordings for years and years, and so we managed to, our language is not probably going to go extinct. It could if we don't keep working at it, but we've managed to save our language.
Which obviously, with courses that you're talking about and other educational programs, is helping save it, and that's no doubt a big push for that language, as you're saying, to not go extinct, and not just that language, but other First Nations languages. It's important to keep those alive through whatever means possible.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, there's words and concepts in Halkominum that have no equivalency in English, and they don't even describe it. Like it's hard to describe what those words are using the English language, because English is kind of clumsy in that regard and specific.
Now, our research department has learned that you take issue with Duncan's nickname as the City of Totems, since Cowichan culture doesn't really have totem poles. There are house poles and welcoming poles and memorial poles, but the idea of a big wooden pole telling a story is really something more practiced by other First Nations. So let's talk misconceptions here, Miggy. What are the top misconceptions about Cowichan culture and history held by non-Cowichan people?
Well, I'm sort of in a unique situation in that I was part of the 60s scoop. I was taken from my family when I was a baby, and I was placed into a non-Indian home, and I was raised in non-Native culture. And so my idea of what being a First Nations person was largely influenced by Disney and books and extraneous resources that had nothing to do with Coast Salish culture. So when I came home 20 years ago, I spent 5 years looking for my family, and I finally connected with them when I was 21 years old. I'm 48 now. So I've been coming home for some 26 years. When I finally connected, I had to unlearn all these ideas about what being Native was. And, one thing is the idea that Native people don't have a concept of property rights. And the fact is, if you research Coast Salish people and you go into the archaeological record, we had very clear systems of property rights and concepts for trespass in our Tsleil-Waututh that people, when you enter our territory, if you want to get off your canoe and step on the beach, we have a whole ceremony for welcoming you onto the beach, which is a system of like giving you permission to step foot on the beach after you've done the appropriate protocol to be welcomed. So that was the major thing I learned, was I had to unlearn Hollywood's idea of what being a Native person was, and really immerse myself in my own people's culture, which was not easy.
And is that something that you find is still a case for people who are in the position that you were in just talking about then, that it is kind of learning to push away that Hollywood perception of what the culture is to learn the truth behind it?
Absolutely. We still have people who are First Nations from back east, and they come out to Coast Salish territory here, and the cultural differences between a Coast Salish person and a Mohawk person are immense. Coast Salish people have a tradition of non-confrontation in terms of our interactions. We are masters at making relationships with other people. That's the basis of Tsleil-Waututh, is to sort of treat people in a holistic way and to build relationships with them. And so you don't solve, in our culture, you don't solve things by being aggressive and being blunt and direct, whereas that's a quality of virtue in people back east is they're more direct. They can be a bit more abrasive. And sometimes there's clashes between the two different groups of people because we simply don't understand each other's sort of different cultures.
You're talking about education with languages before. Is that a similar aspect with teaching in schools or in other aspects for that, so that people are aware of those differences, not only between the cultures, but everything you were just mentioning there as well?
Well, unfortunately, in the kindergarten through grade 12 school system, they sort of take a pan-Indian approach to teaching Native culture. For instance, my son, it rubs him the wrong way. He's 14 and he's in the private school or public schools here in Victoria. And they have a education segment about the Good Red Road. And they were talking about the medicine wheel. And these are concepts that are sort of pan-Indian. And it's kind of a hodgepodge of different cultures that have been put together to create this curriculum. So there really isn't a place that you can go to learn Coast Salish culture, aside from the language, which is available through the universities. You really have to immerse yourself in the culture to learn it. And I was fortunate in that I had family when I came home that would allowed me to do that to some extent.
And is that something that is welcomed if somebody wants to go and do that and immerse themselves in that culture?
No, not really.
It's, how do you kind of cross that barrier then for people who are wanting to do exactly what you're saying?
If you're not Coast Salish, it would be very difficult to immerse yourself in the culture unless you are married into the family or adopted into the tribe in some way through a grandmother or a mother that wanted to take you on. It's just, the impact of colonialization has been that our culture is sacred, or chacha is the word for it, which means to not show it, to be private about the sacred elements of our culture. And so there isn't really, there's cultural exchanges that go on all the time that are natural and occurring, but it would be very difficult for a non-Coast Salish person to be able to tap into that rich reservoir that does exist for actual Coast Salish people.
Want to change tack slightly here, Megan. Okay. I mean, we're right in the middle, of course, of the onset of a second wave of COVID. And COVID's something you were taking more seriously a lot more than most in the very early months of the pandemic. Through social media, you were a very vocal proponent of masking, which I think is fair to say you have been proved right since. You've also written for us about why pandemics strike a much more profound chord with Indigenous communities. Can you care to explain a little bit more about this?
Well, I think the main thing I was concerned about looking at what we know about COVID is that the communicability of it is so much more than many other pathogens that we're familiar with, so far as we know. And there's so much poverty in my community, and there's so many people that are in overcrowded housing. And so the disease running rampant through the community has been my biggest fear, that we would lose, especially because elderly people are more susceptible to dying from COVID. So that's why I was panicked at the beginning of the pandemic about the lack of use of masks. And I encouraged people to make masks at home. And that sort of took off within the community when masks weren't available because we didn't have supplies. So that was the main reason that I was so concerned, is because the overcrowding and poverty, impoverished situation that many of my relatives are in made them more susceptible to the impact of COVID.
And since those early warnings and the position we're in right now, how have you seen it looking in those communities right now, given the more awareness and, you would assume hopefully more people following these protocols that maybe they weren't taking seriously at the beginning?
With the virus, I've kind of lost hope in humanity, to be honest. There's so much misinformation floating around about the use of masks, the efficacy. People don't understand the concept of viral loading, that yes, masks aren't 100% effective, but if you wear a mask, it can stop you from getting a larger viral load if you decrease your viral load, it decreases the chance of your illness being that severe if you get the COVID. And people don't understand that. And they think that, I mean, there's all this weird conspiracy stuff that's floating around. And luckily, in my community in Cowichan, people are taking it seriously and people are masking up and taking as many precautions as they possibly can. But it's hard. You know, it's been months that this has been going on. And I can see that we're, you know, people are sort of getting it to their breaking point when it comes to social distancing and mask wearing and all the things that we're supposed to be doing. And we're just getting started here with the counts that are rising every day and the number of patients that we've got on the island now.
You recently wrote a column on The Line, a comment site run by a friend of the podcast, Jen Gerson, objecting to the backlash that John Horgan received when he said, "I don't see color." Can you explain what you were arguing with this?
Oh, well, I'm 48 years old. And grew up in the 70s and the 80s. And when I was growing up, the use of the phrase being colorblind or not seeing color in other people and trying to, like Martin Luther King said, judge people by the contents of their character and not by the color of their skin, that was de rigueur for people being anti-racist all of my life. And it's only been recently, in the last 2 or 3 years, as I understand it, that now saying that you don't see color actually, according to the woke movement, means that you're a racist or indeed a white supremacist. And I don't agree with that at all. I take issue with the idea that trying to judge people as individuals is racist. And especially, you know, this idea that Martin Luther King had that you judge people based on the content of their character more than anything else and their actions rather than on what their inheritable characteristics are.
What was the turning point that you think that brought us to this moment where you go from that period in history to now where we are right now, where people are taking issue with people saying that they don't see color?
I think it's a moral panic that's occurring that I've actually got another article coming out on The Line about these changes to our language and how, as a writer, I find organic changes to the language to be more natural, like occurring over time and are adopted at a slower rate as being acceptable or reasonable. But these forced implementations of woke critical race theory are unnatural. And they're just, I think they're actually, it's sort of an assault on the English language, which I take personally as a writer. I don't like that. I don't like that they're trying to force new terminology and new words on people and alter the meaning of words that we've used for a long time because it makes communication increasingly difficult in an already polarized world.
You're talking about putting another story together there for The Line. You're also putting together a story for us looking at a topic that is getting a lot of resonance with our audience lately, basically the gaps in mental health care that are precipitating homeless. When you look at how the province and city are addressing homelessness, Miki, what do you think policymakers are overlooking at the moment?
They're not giving people enough money in terms of the... If someone is addicted and mentally ill, my research indicates that the amount of money that they get for disability, I think it's like $1,300 a month, is simply not enough for anyone to survive. And over the last 10 years, inflation has decreased the purchasing power of the dollar so that so that the cost of living goes up, but the amount of money that you're getting from the government to live or survive keeps decreasing. And so unfortunately, as this keeps going on, it creates more and more people who find themselves unable to make rent. And even if they can make rent, you know, then they don't have any money for food for the entire month. And then, you know, they make your existence so miserable that medicating yourself out of, you know, the horrible situation that you find yourself in is preparable to being stone cold sober in those circumstances. And then we have, you know, that's where we have the opioid crisis going on with so many of the people that are homeless or people that use meth as a way of coping with what's going on in their lives if they're homeless. So I really think that the government needs to be, as far as I see it, they've got to increase the amount of money that they actually pay out to people who are mentally ill and on disability and who need that help. That's the only solution that I can see that would actually solve and address some of these problems.
And given we've just had an election, John Horgan's got back in now with a majority, do you feel that this is something that's on the cards, or do you feel that this isn't something that's going to change anytime soon?
I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. I think a lot of people blame Mayor Helps and the city council for the homeless issue, and I think it's a province-wide issue. It's a Canada-wide issue from the research that I did into it, and it's just, you can't just endlessly print money out of thin air and depreciate the value of the dollar without there being some impact on the economy. And what we're seeing in the homeless crisis is that impact in the economy. But no one wants to talk about that.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye out for that article coming soon to the Capital Daily, as well as the Brush Up Your Salish regular segment as well. Meggie, it's been a pleasure to chat with you today and learn more about the topics we've talked about. Thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, all the day's news, plus we bring you your favourite weekly segment, Fun Fact Friday, next. Get connected to over 41,000 subscribers each day with one of the smartest, largest, and most engaged news audiences on the West Coast, all while supporting Vancouver Island's most dynamic source for in-depth news and analysis. Visit capitaldaily.ca for more details. To today's news now, and Provincial Health Officer Dr. Bonnie Henry has announced wide-ranging new rules for controlling the spread of COVID-19, including mandatory masks in indoor public and retail spaces, and restricting social gatherings to household members only for everyone across BC. According to CBC, the new orders and guidelines come as another 538 cases of COVID-19 have been confirmed in BC, and one more person has died. As of Thursday, there are 6,929 active cases of the virus across the province. Dr. Henry said the restrictions meant that nobody should be meeting for social reasons with anyone outside of their immediate household, as well as implementing mandatory mask wearing for workers and members of the public in all retail environments, restaurants, and indoor public spaces, including common areas of workplaces, except when eating or drinking. The order for mandatory masks is effective Thursday. CBC also added that high-risk indoor group fitness activities, including high-intensity interval training, hot yoga, and spin classes, will be suspended as well, with in-person face services suspended and no spectators allowed at any indoor or outdoor sport, and no travelling outside the local community for sports. Oak Bay Police Sergeant Davinder Dalep is under investigation after a court order was served to him earlier this month for fear of injury and damage by another person. The order restricts Dalep from having contact with a woman and four members of her family, and also prohibits him from carrying firearms or restricted weapons aside from the firearm required when he is on duty. Oak Bay Police Chief Ray Bernottes told Victoria News that Dalep has been reassigned to administrative duties and will be subject to an external investigation. And the biological mother of baby Jessica will not be facing charges after the Crown decided the case was not in the public interest. Charges of abandonment were recommended by Westshore RCMP after the now-grown Adriana Bonner tracked down her birth parents earlier this year. Bonner had been abandoned as a baby in a Coalwood ditch in 1986, where she was found by three teens. In a Facebook post, Bonner expressed her disappointment with the decision. "It's been 34 years, so it's okay you threw your newborn into a ditch," was how she characterised the Crown's position. And before we go today, it's time for your favourite weekly segment, Fun Fact Friday. This week brought to you by flying. And an interesting fact about your taste buds when you're on a plane. Did you know that you lose up to 30% of your taste buds during a flight? According to a 2010 study conducted by Germany's Fraunhofer Institute for Building Physics, the dryness experienced at a high elevation as well as low pressure reduces the sensitivity of a person's taste buds to sweet and salty foods by almost 30%. Add that dry cabin air affects our ability to smell, and our ability to taste is reduced further. So that basically explains, of course, why airline food maybe gets such a bad reputation. I'm sure if you actually eat it on the ground, then it's probably the best food you've ever tasted. Maybe there's a restaurant idea in there somewhere. And that's it today for the Capital Daily Podcast for Friday, November 20th, 2020, as well as the week. Got to give myself a shameless plug right now, as I have my first full Capital Daily article published right now, which you can read on capitaldaily.ca. In it, I sat down with a couple of local Olympians and found out just how the delay of the Tokyo Games affected them and just what it means ahead of their medal hopes for the now postponed Games in 2021. That website again, to check it out, capitaldaily.ca. My name is Ben Waterworth, and as they say in Australia, ripper. Thanks for tuning in. Have a safe and enjoyable weekend, and I will speak to you on Monday. Today's edition of the Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by us, Capital Daily. With a committed audience of over 41,000 people, get connected with some of the smartest, hippest people on the West Coast. For more details, visit capitaldaily.ca. Introducing the Capital Daily's Weekly Photo Challenge. Each week, our team will post a weekly photo theme in Monday's Capital Daily newsletter, as well as announcing it right here on the podcast, with winners receiving gift cards to local Victoria businesses around town. This week's theme is architecture. To find out how you can enter, check out Monday's Capital Daily newsletter.